Good evening, my friends. Welcome to Tahrir, Voices of the Arab Muslim Community, here and abroad, coming to you every Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. over Peace and Justice Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. But please, we invite you to visit our new webpage, www.radiotahrir.org. That's RadioTahrir.org, where we have audio samples from our archives, as well as new and ongoing programs. And now let's go to today's program. I'm Barbara Nimri Aziz. On Tahrir today, D.H. Melhem reads from her latest poetry collection. Asma Shikoh, mixed media artist, is interviewed by Fatima Ashraf. And we will hear the first part of our exclusive interview with Iran's Kamanche virtuoso, Kehan Kelhor. First, Asma Shikoh. Asma Ahmed Shikoh is a mixed media visual artist based in Hoboken, New Jersey. Earlier this year, her exhibition, Liberated, was on display at the Cirrus Gallery in New York City. Tahrir's Fatima Ashraf viewed the show and spoke to the artist.
Asma Shikoh, he is an up-and-coming artist and has a fascinating exhibition, Liberated, the celebration of Muslim women who wear hijab. Assalamu alaikum, Asma.
Wa alaikum assalam and salams to all the listeners.
You were born and raised and educated in Pakistan, correct?
Yes, I grew up in Karachi, and that's where I studied, the Indus Valley School of Art and Architecture.
What led you to art as a career?
I guess mom's a painter. But the career choice actually happened much later. I actually graduated from high school in commerce. And then I shifted my career completely and I ended up in fine art. This was a great new school. They were experimenting with a lot of techniques, teachers, and it was fun.
Did you specialize at all?
Yes, in painting, and I minored in printmaking.
You recently immigrated to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about what it was like adjusting to America as a Muslim woman who wears hijab, who is an artist.
Karachi is a metropolitan city, so the city switch wasn't that difficult for me. As an artist, again, I connected to the South Asian Women's Creative Collective, and there's an artist group in Hoboken, which I joined, which does little shows in the town. So the hijab thing and the consciousness of being a Muslim and realizing how important it is in New York more than Pakistan came when I moved here. And I actually started wearing the hijab just this year, alhamdulillah.
Hijab is the Muslim woman's modest cover. It's iconically seen in the world as the headscarf. Asma, let's talk about your exhibition, the mm-hmm. show. It's called Liberated. It is a fantastic celebration of Muslim women who wear hijab.
I had always been a little uncomfortable, especially after starting to wear the hijab, uncomfortable to see that the depiction of the headscarf in the arts was mostly negative or controversial or ambiguous. I thought we need to start taking ownership of it and move beyond controversy. This is a piece of cloth that we wear as an act of faith, and I can take ownership of it and do whatever I want with it. And I wanted to also sort of prove that Muslim women are part of the American culture as much as any other woman is, and we are contributing members of society.
I visited you there. Mm-hmm. Pieces that stick out the most in my mind are the superhero ones. Mm-hmm. And I love those because they're Muslim women dressed in hijab depicted as superheroes. One of them is called the Storyteller, and she's wearing a red superhero outfit and looks just ready to save the world. And the second is called the Healer. She's wearing green and she has these fantastic boots on, and she's holding what looks like a crystal ball in one of her black gloved hands. Tell us what led you to depicting these hijab-clad women as superheroes.
So these superheroes come from realizing that superhero culture is so part of the American culture. Why not Muslim superhero women? That's what I did. Americanized the hijab. They're dressed very conservatively. They have the hijabs, definitely, but the rest of the clothing is also very modest. One's wearing a tall skirt. The inspiration of that one, which is the healer, is from the Turkish Sufi dervish. The others is one wearing a red jalab, which is, again, it's very modern and aggressive. And the third one has a lot of gold boots and gold chains. I had lots of fun with it, but again, I kept them very modest, simple, as compared to the superheroes, heroines that we see in American culture, which are all about the body and showing it off. And
another one of my favorite pieces superimposed the outline of a muhajaba woman's head onto a janimaz. And a janimaz is a prayer rug. Tell us a little bit about how that piece was formed.
This is part of a series of works that I've done for this show, where I started off from little sketches and then to bigger ones, where I really simplified the template of a headscarf. And then I enlarged it on 5 paintings. In one of these, I have the one that's called My Prayer, which is the prayer rug. The other one I did with metro cards, again, depicting different aspects of my life. One is, again, a collection of New York City scenes, and they're all superimposed on these headscarf templates. In doing so, I was trying to just have the viewer acknowledge that the headscarf, let's accept it. It's a part of my life. It's a very important part of my life. But I have other things as well. It is a small, visible part of a bigger value system that I follow. That life has a lot of things happening in it. As you saw at the show when you were there, that there I've done a small template with Dora figures on it.
Dora as in Dora the Explorer.
Dora the Explorer, because I have a 3-year-old and this is all I did the past 3 years, listen to Dora. Then there's one which is painted like an iPod, again depicting the New York American lifestyle.
Talk a little bit about that MetroCard piece. Basically what Esma did was cut up a bunch of metro cards and put them together, and it created that same silhouette of the hijabed head that she has repeated throughout the exhibition. But this one, how did you cut those cards?
Well, me and my husband have been collecting metro cards. I think it took around 1,000 metro cards to make that piece, because it's just fairly large.
Yeah.
And I took one of the Islamic patterns from Alhambra Mosque. Alhambra in Granada.
The geometric repetitive pattern. Okay.
So I have that, and I cut up these metro cards and fitted it into that pattern.
But the part of the metro card that you see.
Yeah. In some of the areas, we see both of the yellow part of the metro card, and I've used the reverse at some places. And the reverse is so interesting because it has the, if you see something, say something, that we see everywhere in New York City now. Like, I feel bad when I see it.
They're targeting you.
Yeah, they're targeting me.
Because the media in the United States has so created this culture around Muslims are responsible for anything that's terrorist related. So if you see something, say something. It's like if you see one of us, say something. Exactly. I feel the same way.
So I call it the metro rap with the R in the rap, metro rap. And it's kind of, you see it so much, it becomes like a rap of if you see something, say something. Okay. So I've used it over and over. And sort of doing that, I realized, okay, maybe we need to lighten up a bit too. And that work is just about having fun with it. If you see something, say something in Spanish, in English.
And maybe realizing that it doesn't have to be, we don't have to take it personally. Like, when we had talked about before, Muslims need to stop being apologetic and stop being so owning. Why don't we own the beautiful aspects of our identity? Why do we own the aspects of our identity that the West tells us we should?
Exactly. And through doing this project, that's why it's called Liberated, because I feel I've been liberated of my own misconceptions about the headscarf, about being tolerant of other people, about not judging people, et cetera, that I came with in this country.
I read on your website in your biographical sketch that as an artist, your main concern is your immediate surroundings.
My work is always about my immediate surroundings. I have to be inspired by something or touched by something to make work. Cityscapes have been my passion, even in Karachi. I continue to do those on the side because they sort of kept me connected to what was happening in the city where I live in. And moving to New York City, the first way I started to connect with the city was do more cityscapes.
The flagship piece of your exhibition, it's called The Beehive. Mm-hmm. And what Asma Shiko did was contact her friends, who then contacted their friends. And there was an email that was circulated throughout the United States calling for Muslim women to submit their hijabs to be part of this installation. And it's a beautiful piece. It's very, creates a strong, powerful sense of solidarity among Muslims, specifically Muslim women, even more specifically Muslim women that wear hijab here in the United States. Tell us about that piece.
I call it the Beehive Project. I had just started to wear the headscarf, and I felt the need to reach out to my friends. I sort of started to ask them, make me something, contribute to this exhibition somehow, and support me. So I thought, okay, just let's keep it simple, and I'll send out a call. And if you agree to presenting a positive, assertive Muslim woman identity in America, that's what I'm trying to do with the show, please send me a hijab. And I wrote up this email and forwarded it to my friends, as you said, and then it got forwarded to their networks and MSAs. And in around 15 days, I got over 200 emails saying, oh, we're so excited about the idea.
Mine included.
Yeah, and I got it for Fatima, which I have placed in the cell, as you saw that.
That was exciting.
You all must come and see Fatima's hijab. So alhamdulillah, I got around 82 hijabs, and I had to tell people, please don't send me any more right now, because I didn't have that much space. And initially, I thought I'd just put up the hijabs. When they come, I'll get probably 10, 15, and I'll put them up and put names and this location and occupations there. But when they started coming, I got long letters and emails and, oh my God, we need to do this. We need to tell people that we're not oppressed or we're not submissive. This is an act of faith and choice. And then people started sending me the importance of the hijab they were sending, the scarf they were sending, and when they wore it. All of the scarves had a special meaning. So when I started receiving them, they became so sacred for me. And I thought I had to do something more than just display them and hang them in the gallery. And then I came up with the beehive idea. And I took the ayahs from Surah Nahal about the beehive, which is in the Quran, the miracle of the bee and how it creates dwellings in mountains. And so I connected with that. And the significant thing about the beehive is that all the worker bees are females. So that was the fun part. And I think all these females coming together and supporting my show could be sort of synonymous with that. And I just created this installation, and it's the first time I've done an installation piece, which is I'm very excited about. And people who come into the gallery, especially the non-Muslims, say it's such a humanist approach to this issue. And we did not know that women actually chose to wear it, or they're not oppressed, or these women have occupations, you know.
And we had talked about how, because you have so many and so many women were interested in donating their mm-hmm. hijabs, mm-hmm. that this would be an ongoing piece.
Yes,
in the
this
future.
Is an ongoing piece. And I take the liberty to announce at the show that if you visit my website, which is www.asmashikoh.com, asmashikoh.com, I will be posting a call for more hijabs soon, inshallah. And I will keep the beehive growing.
We will also have a link to Asma's website on our website at www.radiotahrir.org, as usual. Asma, did you know that Tahrir in Arabic means liberation?
Oh, I had no idea.
So what a perfect, perfect wow. joining of two very positive forces for the Muslim world. Encourage all of you to view this beautiful exhibition, something that Muslim women should especially partake in.
And also, I would like to say that we need to reach out to the community. I personally want to say that we need to realize the importance of arts in promoting a positive voice of the Muslims, it's like your radio is doing here. And that's what I try to do. That's why I did the project as well, the Beehive Project, where I reached out to people. It's a beautiful way of letting people see the other side and accepting it. And
we're not all politics. We're not all news. We are fine arts, music, and everything else that's good in this world.
Yes.
I'm Fatima Ashraf. Thanks for joining us.
Next, we visit with Kehan Kelhor. For many years, New York audiences have watched with growing understanding and, I think, with pride and satisfaction, the development of this extraordinary virtuoso of the Comanche. I'm, of course, speaking about Kehan Kelhor. Since his first CD series, Ghazale, with Shujat Hussein Khan, almost 10 years ago, Kelhor has teamed up with vocalists and with other music masters around the world. Kalhor is currently engaged in the Silk Road project with Yo-Yo Ma. He also continues collaborative work with individual artists. He performs solo and he teaches. Kehan Kalhor's latest CD, The Wind, was released late in 2006. A few weeks ago, we were fortunate to meet with the Iranian artist in New York, and we had a lengthy interview with him. This is just a brief segment from that talk. The full interview will be broadcast later in the summer. First, let's hear a track from The Wind, where Kehan Kalhor is performing with Erdal Erzincan. I'm delighted to meet you again, talk about all kinds of things.
Likewise, it's really nice to be back.
Let's talk about what you're doing now, early in 2007.
I think mostly I'm concentrated right now on my solo work and my duos with the artists from other musical cultures around the world.
You have worked with Kurdish musicians,
yes.
With South Asian, Indian, other Persian, Iranian musicians, and I believe Turkish,
yes.
Musicians.
Yes.
Do they come to you?
I usually find them. Well, you know, I don't look for them, but it just happens. Whenever I hear about an exciting musician, I just research or go to their concerts. This is what happened with Shuja. This is what happened with my friend Ali Ekber Muradi, who I did a project called In the Mirror of Sky. With Erdal, it was different. The promoters in Holland actually approached me. They suggested that you should listen to his music, and we think that you can be the right pair. I did that and researched more. I went to Turkey to meet him. I got 70 CDs to listen of Turkish music and tried to educate myself a little more. I went back a second time and I felt really comfortable doing a project with him. We recorded a couple of years ago in Istanbul and the record is on ECM now. It's called The Wind.
Yes, I like it very much and we heard parts of it at the beginning of this interview. That's rather adventurous of you. We talked about this before, how your instrument, the Comanche, you have taken out of a kind of folk context and brought together with what might be called a higher, I don't like that term, but more classical instruments.
Maybe more active in conjunction with other musical cultures. And I think if I hadn't done it, somebody else would. You know, there are things that they develop at the same time. And I strongly believe that there are times for ideas or inventions or things like that. Just one thing that human beings just neat. You know, I always think about how the airplane was developed. Wright brothers, for example, are credited for that. But in the same time, people in every country were doing the same thing. There was another French inventor that actually did the same thing, but with 24 hours difference. And with telephone, for example, you know, Italy, Sweden, Bell. So all these things, I think there's some ideas. I'm not an inventor, obviously, I'm a musician. There are ideas that there is a right time for them, and everybody thinks that this should happen. So this is one of those things. I think a Persian musician, you know, wandering around, what can I do with the musicians from other cultures? And this is what happens. And if I don't do it, somebody else will. You know, I'm not crediting myself with discovering that. But I think discovery is part of music, and we like to departmentalize everything. Traditional music, traditional musician, classical musician, jazz musician. But the boundaries are not as rigid as we think. Music is music. So if I can find a mutual idea that I could put in work with some other musician that I haven't seen before, or some other musical culture that I'm not very aware of or I'm not educated in, I can play with them and see what happens. If the product is not what I want it to be, so what? I haven't lost anything. I just found a friend and I don't release it on a record. If I like the music that we create, I would release it gladly and be proud of it.
You talked about the flexibility and the change. And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Eastern world has a lot of room, and always has had, for flexibility, for experimentation, for crossing borders.
I think because the treasure is bigger. That's why. When you have this huge treasure, wherever, whenever you put your hands in it, you find something. That part of the world is full of ideas, tradition, history, and precious elements of culture. So it's not strange to me that this happens and you're able to find all those precious elements there. The music being one of them is very rich, especially in Persia and so-called Persian-related cultures that have the same principles in music with a different accent. So I think this is part of what I like to do and find mutual language between myself and other musicians. It's a very, very fascinating project for me because I can learn all the time. There is a certain amount of learning that you can do in your own culture. Not that I know everything, but after a while, you know, you just begin to just rediscover your own music. But it's nice that if you mix that with discovering other musical cultures as well. In this case, I learned a lot about North Indian music, working with Shujaat and traveling to India several times. I learned a lot from Turkish music, from Erdal Erzincan. This is something that I value very much.
Let's take your work with Shujaat Hussain Khan. When you say you learned a lot from, can you help those of us who are not musicians sort of identify the areas in which you were developing with him?
Well, the areas are countless, because one that I'm very fascinated with is cultural. It's not only musical, but when you have to sit down with another musician that you haven't seen before, let's say from North India, you have to learn about their behavior in their musical society. About the lineage, about the continuation of music. How are they received in their own society? What is the role of musician in that society? What is the role of musician in their own understanding? You know, where is a musician in that society? And when it comes to music, how they approach their music, how much they practice, what are the settings that they play their own music? Was his father a musician? Is he living still in a musical family? Is his family interested in his music? It's a lot to learn about what happens around the musician and in that part of the world. And this is all basically non-musical. This is all social. Then when it comes to music, there is a lot more to learn, because I always knew these tunes from that culture, which I liked. And then I found names for them, and I just found about the philosophy behind them. You know, well, this piece came from this part, and it's got a, you know, folk flavor to it. And I learned this from my father. My teacher told me that. I'm very fascinated to learn about all these, and that all this related tunes or melodies that exist in one part of the world. For example, there is a piece, Middle Eastern Arabs play it, North African Arabs play it, Kurdish musicians everywhere play it, and people in Iran play it. And nobody knows where that melody comes from. You know, it's really nice to see that and maybe find out more about how this melody was formed, who was basically responsible for creating it. not that it's possible to understand that at the end, but it's nice to think about it. And it's nice to know that music travels and it's not isolated at one place all the time. I think if we apply that in terms of everyday life and politics and social life, you know, we are going to have a much better life in our countries.
Part of that, Kehan Kelhor, is this feeling of improvisation. I feel that very strongly in your recordings, especially with Shujat Hussain Khan, the Ghazali series. Yes. I feel it. I just feel it. And I think you did mention in an earlier interview how the two of you just clicked. But these recordings, you now have over 12 CDs, they can't be improvisation, can they?
They certainly can because, well, it's not a huge act on our behalf because we're trained to do that. It's not strange if we do it. Ever since you try to learn to play a musical instrument in our culture or North Indian culture or Turkish culture, you are taught to be able to improvise. The whole musical structure, learning method, everything is centered around that. I don't think it's just there are some musicians that can improvise in a more elaborate way, and there are some musicians that can do that less. It's not that if you go through that learning system, it's guaranteed that you're going to be an improviser. You know, that's part of an artistic process that you go through. I give you an example. If you learn English language, you go to school, you learn alphabet, how to read and how to write. You get your high school diploma, you have a certain knowledge of English language. If you want to continue with that and learn more, you will go to college and study more English. And then by the time you get your PhD in English language, that doesn't mean that you're going to be a T.S. Eliot or Shakespeare. Basically, you're supposed to know the literature and you're trained to do that. But the degree of the creation and how complex and how artistic it is basically, you know, goes back to you and how you want to pursue and your understanding of the art and the ability or artistic vision.
So if you want to be playful, for example, and be simple for some reason, perhaps the mood you're in, or perhaps the partner you're playing with, you can. And if you want to be complex, you can. With this, Kamanchi.
I think so. But, you know, I really love simplicity. At this stage of my life and for what I've done, I'm very, very, very fascinated by simple things and just simple sound. But I think I'm mostly thinking about depth in music. There was a time when I was much younger, I was in love with playing really fast technical stuff on the kamancha, yes. That was the kind of music I like to create. Nowadays, as I age more, I am paying more attention to depth, to sound, to simplicity, as I said. And you can say things with being simple that they really make your listener think, just with a phrase.
This is just a segment from that visit with Kehan Kahor. The full interview will be broadcast later in the summer. We turn now to our interview with D.H. Melham. Two new novels in her series Patrimonies have just been released by Syracuse University Press. D.H. joined us in our WBAI studios in New York.
I'm just thrilled to be here.
Well, D.H., I'd like to get right down to your poetry. It's been a long time since I've heard you read your poetry, although I know you're active on the scene in New York and around the country, and you're very productive. You've produced at least 4 books in the last 3 years. Perhaps some of our listeners are unfamiliar with your work. Why don't we just start with a poem?
Okay. I'll read from New York Poems. That was published in 2005 by Syracuse University Press. I write a great deal about my neighborhood. My first 2 books, Notes on 94th Street and Children's House of Fire, are both about New York City and my neighborhood. The scene in this poem, Broadway Music, was more typical in the 1970s. The musicians at the newsstand are singing. They sing and play instruments. The saxophone and crack guitar bowl and whine over exhaust fumes and garbage dust. They play and play, the dirty black cap open between them on the ground, 2 old men for pennies. And the big drunken woman laughs over her balloon stomach. She pulls up her sweater to show it, the string holding up her skirt hanging from the big white belly. She laughs through the space between her teeth. Her mouth looks purple and half vacant when she opens it. She shows the old man her distended belly as if it were fruitful or cherished. She lifts her paper bag to her mouth like a trumpet and drinks. She is singing now, softly. Then begins a hard, hoarse cry of a note and holds it. She is singing. A little wine left in the bottle. The flavor that was in it, a harsh joy in the emptying. And the old men sing with her. They dream through the curving wood and metal and the forms of the sounds that go out, as if the dirty newspapers in today's news, the people running up subway stairs, the dogs, the pimps, the hustlers, the gleaning-eyed girls, the howling police cars, their bullhorn commands, the litter and dust-filtered daylight, as if these held the moment of art, as if it could be made from the unlovely flesh, half clay, half dust, as if it could all be molded again and the players were gods, empowering a new music. The big-bellied woman and the musicians at the newsstand.
D.H. Melham, my guest today on Tough Rear, reading from her 2005 publication, New York Poems. I'm going to ask you actually to follow that up with another poem from that because, well, here we are in Manhattan, and yeah. These are Manhattan poems.
Yeah.
You have a very special voice there. So much of what we hear from poets about New York tends to be the ethnic, maybe the Jewish quarter or the Latino quarter or African-American quarter. The part that you're talking about, the Upper West Side, which you mentioned is sort of undergoing a gentrification, maybe has lost its appeal as an inspiration for art. Maybe you're saying, hey, there's a lot going on here.
And there still is a lot of what I was writing about in the 1970s. It may be masked more. It may be undercover or disguised, but it's there. People may be better dressed. That doesn't mean that they have more money, that they have more food on the table, that they can pay their medical and dental bills. the poems are still valid in the sense that there are these cries.
What you're saying is, in fact, there is a lot of the tension of life, lot of the realities that you see in your neighborhood.
It's still there. It's really still there. Now, here's a woman I call Tough Babe. She used to beg at my corner, and she begged in a very distinctive way. And I call her Tough Babe. The poem is Tough Babe Doesn't Beg. Tough Babe doesn't beg. She says, gimme. Gimme a quarter. Gimme a dime. Gimme. Demands her due. Asserts her worth to the street. No, please. It isn't a favor. You're not absolved by giving. Something in your pocket belongs to her, she believes. And then I have a few children's poems.
Yes, I always like children's poems. Yeah. Okay.
School day. Under my bed by the wall, I hide from my mother. She is holding my sister's shoes. Mine are at Drago's, not ready. Kids say my clothes are too small or too big, what somebody gave. I hate school. Will not wear the shoes of my sister. Moving in. Moving in, I see white faces only. Boy staring over his bike. Girl says, hello. It's scary, only white faces. Hope I make friends. We're integrating the building. So it only takes one, right?
Right. Yes, I notice the cover of your book, New York Poems, has a very nice photo of five or six children clampering over rocks with the silhouette of the skyscrapers in New York in the background. That maybe says a lot about your energy, I think.
I love that photograph. I had the privilege of selecting it. I went to the Museum of the City of New York, which is another undiscovered treasure, or I think it's being discovered, treasure of the city. And they have an extraordinary collection of photographs. And I went through hundreds of photographs for the cover. And when I saw it, when I saw this picture of the children clambering over rocks in Central Park, I thought, that's it. I knew this was exactly what I wanted to say about the city, that it still had energy and youth and hope.
Now, you have written a play about the city. Now, this collection of poems, which includes earlier work, I guess it's still furnishing a lot of inspiration for you. Of course, the essence of what you want to say is in the poetry, but talk about the city a little bit. I mean, you're here. You've been here 40, 50 years.
The city, to me, is really expressive of the essence of culture, torment, economic growth, economic blight. It's everything, and on a grander scale than appears in different parts of the country. And I think that if you really absorb the city, if you take it into your consciousness, the West Side has always been kind of a political nexus. People demonstrate and they disagree, and we had lots of problems and disagreements about schools and other matters and peace, and especially about the Vietnam War, and of course now the new Vietnam War, that still problems were resolved peaceably. And I remember one time we had Reform Democrats in the neighborhood. It was a Reform Democratic Club. They disagreed about something, and one group came in and issued subpoenas to the other group, but they were still Democrats, and nobody hit anybody. And
well, my feeling, knowing you for maybe now 15 years, D.H., is that you find a high degree of civilization in New York, and I think this is very important to you.
It is extremely important, terribly important to me. Because if you think this world has a future, some people don't right now, but we are one world and we've got to live together. And I think, well, actually, to make it familiar, to make different races or, and you see that nothing human is alien, nothing shocks you. I think it was Seneca or somebody who said that, but nothing human is alien to me. And that's the kind of world I want to live in. That's the kind of world that is livable for everybody to live in. one thing about getting older, as apparently I have. You see how short life is. And to shorten it for other people, and especially for young people, without giving them a chance and sending them off to war, this to me is madness.
I'd like to have your assessment of the literary scene. There are a lot of poetry venues in the city now compared to, I don't know, 20 years ago. Of course, it's a very dynamic aspect of life. What is your take on that?
My take on that is that it's a wonderful thing. This is part of the richness that I love about the city. There are so many different kinds of venues, and they appear all the time. I don't get around the way I used to, but I know what's going on, and it's not just Manhattan. It's happening in Queens. It's happening in Brooklyn. It's happening in Staten Island.
Absolutely.
There are many, many readings, and maybe it's a wonderful contagion. More people are writing poetry and not afraid to say they're poets. And then even if they're afraid to say they're really poets, they will get up and they'll read it in an open reading.
This is something that I think is very exciting. It almost has returned to its oral origins. Poetry
yes.
is very much of an oral tradition.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's fun. Often,
yeah.
These readings are fun, and it is nice to see people not taking it too seriously. Even if the poem is serious, the performance is just an interaction with possible readers, and it probably stimulates the sale and reading of more books in any
case.
Oh,
I think it does. Yeah. I think it does.
You are listening to my guest, D.H. Melham. She is a poet and the author of three novels, which constitute a trilogy, Stigma, Cave, and Blight. The latter two will be coming out this spring, 2007. And her latest book of poetry, from which she read earlier, is called New York Poems, published in 2005, again by Syracuse University Press. Time for another poem, D.H.
Oh. I used to be a park mother, which means I used to take my two little children to the park, and that was Riverside Park. I am in the park, and you are in the park, beset by fences twisted, sharpened at the top. Swing high, I'll catch you. Crawl up the slide, I'm with you, my hands at your back. I am the station of handkerchiefs. A boy in the sandbox hits you as I sit with the news. I see your fist, the future, hit back. Tomorrow is what it was.
D.H., in 2003, Icon published your book of poems, Conversation with a Stonemason. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear you read from that. But where does that title come from?
The title comes from a triptych, three wonderful photographs by Sharon Lockhart. They were taken at the Oaxacan Exhibit Hall, National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, and they were shown at the Whitney Biennial Exhibit a few years ago. I went back to the museum a few times, and I just stared, and I felt as if I were in conversation with this stonemason. Enrique speaks. Senora, you visit me again. Each time you stare and write in your notebook, you stare so deeply. I am at work and feel comfortable and, since you are curious, happy among my ancestors from a wealthy past. Never mind my overalls and my labor. I like to work here, to be with them. Something grand in their presence. They speak to me. They drop their time into my pockets. Do not look at me and say, poor Enrique. Centuries ago, his people were rich. Look at me and say, Enrique, I know you are a rich man.
D.H. Melham is my guest, and she was reading from her 2003 collection, Conversation with a Stonemason. D.H., I noticed you have in this at least three poems focusing on Palestinian people, Lebanese people, the struggle for statehood there. And if listeners are not aware, I can say I think that you are of Arab heritage, so it's only reasonable that you should be addressing your art to the struggle of our peoples here and overseas. Could you read one of those poems, Shahab or the Palestinian People?
This was from the 1980s. I saw young Palestinian men interviewed on television. And they said, "We do not want bread, we want freedom. We are men, not animals. We are human beings." Shabab, these stones hurl their little cries. You break them from your bloody flesh. They come out of your houses and hearths. They drizzle defiance on barbed wires. You say you have nothing to lose. Daily the wind that drifts your youth across Gaza and Sinai whirls it around minarets and issues from the mouths of muezzins. Each stone transforms your graves into hailstones.
I'd like to, however, talk about the voice of the Arab artists in particular. There are a lot of young creative people, many more than when we first met, example, which was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There are a lot of poets, screenwriters, actors, comedians on the scene, especially in a city like New York. They are, to a large degree, also addressing the conflicts, the rage, the injustice in general, whether it's injustice here, which they're experiencing, lack of opportunities or accusations, or whether it's the continuing violence and deprivation of their own peoples. Mm-hmm. How do you read this talent? Is it finding its target? Is it doing something to stir the public here and remind the general public just what the United States is supporting in terms of injustices around the world?
I think it has a great potential, first of all, that it exists and it's strengthening. It's very important. I think of people like Suher Hamad, Naomi Shihab Nye, Moshe Kaf, Hayan Sharara is a wonderful poet, Khalid Matawa. The important thing is that they exist and they will proliferate. I think that to have a voice, you must seek out venues other than those that are distinctly comfortable to your own group or your own ethnicity. Go there and support them. That is terribly important. But there are others. Go and proliferate.
I find it very encouraging. And all these people that you mentioned, in fact, have been on WBAI airwaves and they've been my guests on Tahrir. Let me remind our listeners that you are with D.H. Melham, New York-based poet. She's been reading from New York Poems, published in 2005, and Conversation with a Stonemason. D.H., we're almost finished, and we haven't talked about your novels. I'd like to do that, particularly because you have a forthcoming publication of a combined two-novel set, Stigma and Cave, and they follow an earlier publication, Blight. Let's talk about writing a novel. Of course, many people who begin writing poetry eventually write novels. You're still writing poetry, and I think of you first and foremost as a poet. But why are you putting attention to novels now?
I've always enjoyed writing fiction as well as poetry. I started writing poetry when I was 8 years old. I did write stories. My stories always needed to say something, especially during my undergraduate years. I discovered people like Orwell and Franz Kafka, and I wanted stories that would say something. And I was interested in fantasy and satire. And these The three books were begun in the 70s, actually in the 60s. I wanted to say something about our world. Blight, the first one, published in 1995, and it took about 25 years, you know. I think it's important for a writer to have stamina, concentration, and dedication, which may verge on obsession. I started with Blight. The three novels, I concede at almost the same time, Stigma and the Cave are in the same vein. Stigma is a satire on the government military industrial complex. It's a short novel, but it's kind of wild. The Cave is a story about a post-nuclear holocaust, and people trying to survive and going to live in a cave. I call the three patrimonies because my question is, what kind of world are we leaving behind? With Blight, you start out with these very strange little people who are actually growing out of the ground. They're teeny. It has a lot to do with environmentalism, how we're poisoning the earth. Then Stigma is a story of a family in this lovely country where families are conscripted by lottery. And everybody in the family goes to serve war in one way or another.
And the third?
And the third is The Cave. Its story there is that there is a war, a nuclear war. These people try to survive by going to live in an abandoned cave. And what happens to them, their interactions, and their quest for survival is not met in any usual or profitable way.
Well, we'll look forward to that. We're just wrapping up now, so why don't we hear one more poem? Perhaps going back to New York Poems, D.H.
The last poem I'll read is Prospect, and it's the last poem in the book. And it was originally inspired by the Angel Project, New York's Lincoln Center Festival in 2003. As if the bridges, islands could be lifted by angels. Steel, the concrete, stones and bricks, the people in their speed and sorrows, into a band of sunlight, cars and windows, each revolving door, the trash and treasure, hope, the Bibles, Torahs, Qurans, Buddhist scripts, 1,000 sacred texts, discarded with computers and their screens gone blank above a gutted theater, whose bare-gummed stage faces the orchestra with seats ripped out like a toothless mouth, while aged men in boats lie still below a bridge. Lift them, lift the young men and the girls who stare out windows like blank-eyed caryatids in a building whose highest floors are empty, tenanted by angels, sometimes seen with folded wings as they lie asleep on carpets. Then descend to the street. Go down 3 levels of subway, down by escalator, through those ghostly spaces, clutching at dust of vanished streets and shops, the ragged sounds of wheels on cobblestones, the trolleys, milkmen, each remembered face, drums of every parade and public grief, keep treading into the chambers of the heart. Keep moving, rise, go out and up the street, to rooms with rows of empty lockers, names in chalk to be erased at will or whim, an island of standing coffins on a feathered floor where phantom birds abide, alongside parakeets in cages that survey the public library and people reading. Lift the dreaming floors with all their books, call numbers, references, the language pillars of the world. Lift them to sky, another planet to begin again. Lift the forgiven past, the judging present, future inspecting it, funneled into ears as memorabilia no one recalls yet holds aloft as trophy, like the sound of whirring rattle on New Year's Eve. Cobbling out of thrum and clatter, yammer of machines and people blasting rock to quarry something durable and prime, we meant to take some wisdom with us and note that we were here, we suffered, we endured, and that we tilled a little while this tall and tiny city wounded at the tip, and posed a wonder among exploding stars.
Thank you so much, D.H. D.H. Melham has been my guest on Tahrir today, reading especially her latest collection of poems, New York Poems. And you can find out much more about D.H. and her work on her webpage at www.dhmelham.com. D.H., bye-bye. Thanks
bye-bye.
So
Thank
much.
Thank you
been wonderful
so much. Great
again.
Being with you.
This is Barbara Nimri Aziz, thanking you for joining us on Tahrir Today. Please visit our new website, www.radiotahrir.org. There you'll find excerpts from our rich audio archives, articles and book reviews by our members, and poems and prayers. Tahrir is produced by Aisha Adawiya, Hassan Abdullah, Fatima Ashraf, and Aydin Baltachi. Go in peace and health, and return in peace and health.